Hello, Garland Nixon here. We're going to talk about fascism, imperialism, and the richest man in the world leading a revolution in the UK. Let's talk. Hello, Garland Nixon here. It's Tuesday morning, and we're talking with the one and only Jody Brar. And before we get going, certainly a man who's very unhappy. Let's hear a word from Keir Starmer. All right. Keir Starmer is in the house. Jody Brar, great to have you here again. We've got all kinds of craziness going on. Clearly, Keir Starmer's unhappy about the situation. But there's the term revolution is always discussed, and England is finally, Great Britain is finally facing revolution, and it's being led by the richest man in the world. Let's talk about Tommy Robinson, Elon Musk, and their interesting revolution. Jody.
Thanks, Garland. Yes, so for those not living on the shores of perfidious Albion who haven't seen this information, there was a rally arranged, I guess it was a week and a half ago now, in central London, and it was presented in the media as this kind of grassroots uprising of the angry workers of Britain. But the ringleader on our shores is a guy called Tommy Robinson, also known as Stephen Yaxley Lennon. He is a guy who split from what was then the kind of official hardline right, far right group in Britain called the British National Party. He split from them, essentially, it seemed to be over the question of Zionism, because the British National Party had a kind of historic position of just good old fashioned anti-Semitism. Down with the Jews, they did everything. And actually, it was the Jews who invented communism, and that tends to be their line. You know, the Jews did everything. And so they just had this old fashioned, you know, anti-Semitic line, which was kind of long established in the far right. Right. Tommy Robinson was a guy who basically split off and set up this group called, well, we know it as EDL, English Defence League. I don't think it exists now. It's devolved into various other groups. But actually, it was called the English and Jewish Defence League. Right. So it had Zionism essentially baked into it from the beginning. And so we've seen increasingly this sort of funny phenomenon of these so-called English patriots waving the Cross of St. George, which is the flag of England, not Britain, alongside the Israeli flag, you know, the blue and white Star of David and the stripes, you know. So, and deliberately conflating these two things. So they've actually very openly embraced a white supremacist ideology that says Israeli Zionism is good because they are white supremacists like what we are. So, you know, this is their kind of affinity. Interestingly, there's a history to that as well, because fascistic supremacists who were Protestants in the north of Ireland, who were basically working for the British in helping to maintain the occupation and to wage a dirty war against Republicans in the north of Ireland, they also used to regularly wave the Israeli flag, right? And you'll see that white supremacists in South Africa regularly used to wave the Israeli flag. So, you know, birds of a feather really do flock together. We've even seen it in Ukraine, haven't we, that Banderites will wave the Israeli flag, even though, you know, this supremacism that they are identifying with, the Banderites were part of carrying out the Holocaust against the Jews, right? And yet today's Jewish supremacists are very happy to be associated with the Banderites of Ukraine. So again, it shows you this affinity that they all have based on their supremacist ideology that says we're from special groups who are much better than the people all around us. Anyway, that's by the by. this guy, Tommy Robinson, that's his kind of, you know, kind of a little bit of his origin story. But somewhere along the line, and probably I would imagine very early in his story, he actually became a British state asset. He's in and out of prison. But what's interesting about the in and out bit is how much he comes out. And he's always out when they want him out. Right? And I think from what I understand, he does good recruitment work inside prisons as well. So he's held up as this, you know, the prison thing. It's a bit like the way that we'll come to France later, won't we? But the way that Le Pen is held up as this anti-establishment figure is actually a very important narrative for persuading angry workers who are cynical about the establishment to pin their hopes on this person. So they're doing it with Le Pen, and it's actually a way to get her into the presidency in a few years' time on a mass wave of people who think they're voting against the establishment, and she'll be brought into power, and she'll be like Giorgia Meloni and, you know, all those other right-wingers who get in and then do all the NATO stuff that they're doing, right?
Trump.
But so with Tommy Robinson, they've created this myth of him as this real rebel, that he's anti-establishment. He's somehow doing something the establishment don't want him to do. And of course, the story is the establishment wants immigration, and the real good revolutionary working class position is to be against immigration because, you know, the establishment's pushing it on us and they're deliberately destroying us and our culture and our everything. And there's this whole narrative that's been built around that, and presenting Tommy Robinson as this kind of figurehead for the anti-immigration revolution is a really important kind of narrative manipulation that's being played on workers who don't understand what's being done to them. So Tommy Robinson is basically a state asset. He's a provocateur. His role is to keep workers' anger harnessed and directed in the wrong direction, right? Blame other workers, don't blame the rich. Now, you almost couldn't make this up. The imaging of it actually is so bad. And yet, we've seen Elon Musk stoking the culture war around immigration insistently, persistently, consistently since he took over Twitter. He endlessly posts and amplifies posts which will push hard on narratives that are circulated by provocateurs in Britain, which say that, for example, immigrants are responsible for rape gangs. Right. Not that there's a culture problem in Britain and that, the grooming of kids has been going on by the ruling class, you know, for a very long time for horrible purposes. And sometimes the people they farm that out to on the ground level will be from immigrant communities. Why would they not be? They're people who live here like anybody else who lives here. But it's being presented like it's a cultural thing. There's something about Pakistanis that they're into making rape. No, it's a British, if it's any culture, it's the British ruling class's culture that filters down into the working class, because you get paid for doing these horrible things in a world where there aren't good jobs for people, you know. So this narrative has been pushed very hard by all kinds of provocateurs, and Elon Musk has been amplifying that type of thing. And you'll see Facebook will amplify it. All the big West-controlled, US-controlled, basically, social media platforms work hard to promote culture war narratives and promote the idea that there's this massive groundswell of anger against immigrants, and that immigrants are the ones who are the cause of all our problems, and that the ruling class is somehow the one that is deliberately creating a situation where immigrants are destroying your life, right? All nonsense, but that's the way that this narrative has been set up, and a lot of people are falling for it. You know, they see that they can't get a doctor's appointment, they see that the good jobs have gone, they see all kinds of bad things happening in their communities. And then, of course, the ruling class is in charge of creating this narrative. So there is a deliberate policy, for example, of when asylum seekers land up in Britain, they get lumped in what are called migrant hotels. So basically, their claims are not processed. Sometimes it can take years for an asylum seeker's claim to be processed. During that time, he's not allowed to work. He's got no freedom of movement, really. They put him in what is essentially an open prison. They call it a hotel. And what they do is they'll They'll find a rundown hotel owned by some monopoly corporation in an area that's economically dying, and they'll pay the hotelier an insane amount of money for housing these migrants. Now, it's essentially an open prison and a slum. They're not decent living conditions. The people have no ability to work, to integrate. They don't get English lessons. They don't get any help. The money they have to live on is an absolute pittance. So it's like a starvation level little stipend. But it's presented to the people nearby like, these people have come here and they're living in a hotel and look how badly we're living, right? So then the provocateurs, as soon as they've set up this hotel for migrants, open air prison, as soon as they set up the hotel, then the provocateurs are sent in to go around the community with shiny leaflets and talking points that basically point to some of the real problems that people are having in the area to do with doctors and education and, you know, jobs and all the rest of it. And then to point over there and say, by the way, there's migrants over there and we're paying a fortune to keep them in a hotel. And like, what's up with that? And then there'll be a further provocations, which social media again is used to spread rumors that the people in these hotels have been looking funny at our women, at our children, at our babies. They stole our baby, raped my wife, you know, all this type of stuff. Very often, I'm sure occasionally the story might be true, but 99% of the time they've been shown to be false rumors, but they spread like wildfire. And it creates this upswell of feeling that there's, because you're hearing it constantly repeated from so many directions, it starts to feel like it must be true that somehow these people are a threat and also are the reason that your life is bad, right? So the whole combination goes to create a very antagonistic sense towards immigrants amongst certain sections of the population. I must caveat though here, before I finish the bit about what actually happened, sorry. Just by saying, considering the huge effort that goes into setting up this antagonism, the huge propaganda campaign, which is wall to wall, 24/7, 365 days a year, guarded, it never lets up, the propaganda campaign against immigrants in our country. Given all of that, actually, all these initiatives to stir up a great wave of anti-immigrant patriotism amongst the British people, despite all the news coverage that the little bits of outbursts are getting and all the encouragement they get, they're actually quite small. If you go along to a massive anti-immigrant demonstration outside a migrant hotel, there'll be like a couple of hundred people there and a couple of hundred people in a counter protest. You know, the mass of the British people are not actually engaged in this, despite many of them being convinced that on some level immigration must be a problem because that's all anybody ever talks about, right? So they're doing this, and essentially what seems to have happened the other day in Trafalgar Square is that Elon Musk basically paid Tommy Robinson to rent a crowd, and they had, you know, I don't know what the numbers were. I've seen different numbers reported different places, but let's take them at their word. They managed to get 100,000 people in Trafalgar Square. Well, that's a decent sized crowd. But it was all very theatrical. So this is supposed to be really grassroots rebellion, and yet it's so well organized. They had a massive big screen in Trafalgar Square, not just a big screen that was showing, you know, people on the stage or something. No, this was a big screen with a live link up to Elon Musk sitting across the world, who was beamed in to address the crowd. And while he was addressing the crowd, Tommy Robinson was basically sort of genuflecting before him and getting the crowd to say thank you to Elon Musk for giving us free speech. That's literally what he said. Now, the irony of it is phenomenal when you consider that Elon Musk is one of the primary architects of the wall of censorship that is enveloping the West and being reinforced, you know, so hardly, you know, constantly, and being, you know, double built, double walls, you know, oh, we've built one wall. No, that's not enough. We need another wall. You know, he is a primary architect and a prime mover in this effort to suppress speech and to shape narratives in the interests of the imperialist ruling classes and exclude narratives and suppress narratives that get in the way of the Hollywood machinery of narrative manipulation that the imperialist West has created. So, you know, it's kind of an embarrassment, but something that was noticeable in that very theatrical occasion that was put on by this Unite the Kingdom movement, as it's being called, was there was a kind of was a very weird bit of pageantry at one point. I saw a clip of it. And there were these guys, I don't know what they were supposed to be dressed as. They had like feathers in their hair and kilts on, but everything was in red because they were being St. George's Cross, everything's red and white, right? They had red paint on their faces and everything. I don't know if they thought they were some kind of warriors. It was a little bit embarrassing. They were kind of dancing up and down and Tommy was egging them on from the mic. And they took some flags and ripped them up to show like, oh, we're, you know, who our enemies are. And one of them was something kind of Islamic. Who knows, it might have been the ISIS flag, but it just looked like it could have just been an, you know, it could have just been a prayer flag. I don't know what it was. It just black flag with some Arabic script on it, which would no doubt have been religious, right? And then a Palestinian flag ripped that up, right? So what they're saying is they are fully on board with the Zionist project, and they're telling their people that English patriotism or British patriotism requires them to be Islamophobic, pro-Zionism, and actively against the Palestinian people's quest for liberation and national self-determination. Now, that's an interesting combination of messages, isn't it? Because I can't think of anything less patriotic for a British worker than to be saying to Elon Musk, you know, thank you, Lord, for everything you deliver to us. And we offer our services for all the projects that are dear to you, like suppressing Palestine and boosting Israel.
So this revolutionary conservative pushback against the establishment was pretty much paid for by the richest man in the world, starred the richest man in the world on a gigantic screen, and they ripped up Palestinian flags in service to Zionism. And mm-hmm. they think that this was a grassroots fight pushing back against the man. Okay, well, you know, that's an interesting combination of facts to put together. And I think it kind of speaks for itself. Now, let me ask you this. I didn't realize they literally tore up a Palestinian flag at this thing. Oh, by the way, let me show you something. For those who aren't familiar with the great job that Elon Musk is doing as far as free speech, this is my Twitter account. This, you notice that there's a picture of me, all of my stuff there, joined March 2009. Somebody for some reason went in and decided they were going to scrub it of a whole bunch. Look at this, Mike. That's a scrubbed it. But that's the one that I pay for. They can't figure out who owns this account. But apparently, according to Twitter, the free speech place, it's not me. They just told me, unfortunately, we don't know. We can't figure out who owns this account. Now, granted, they take payment out of my account. So at Garland Nixon, they send emails to garlandin@gmail.com. They take money out of a bank account owned by Garland Nixon, but unfortunately they can't figure out who owns the account. I find that interesting. But at any rate, and there are those who say, Garland, why are you waiting so long to do anything? I've got my reasons. At any rate, so let us continue. As the revolution fires up against the man in the establishment led by Tommy Robinson and Elon Musk, France. What's interesting there is that, as I understand it, people are in the street everywhere. Apparently, they have some gigantic hole in their budget due to neoliberal capitalism. They've got a giant hole in their budget, and they tried to plug it by putting forth a budget that would have massive cuts for social programs, education, healthcare, the usual. It is pretty much the people who are revolting or in the streets are saying the reason we have this is because of all these gigantic tax cuts for the rich and all this extra money for the wealthy and corporations. So in order to plug the hole, you should take that back from them. They should have to plug the hole. I read where some rich guy who's in, who's, you know, representing some organization says, we can't do that because that would be communism. So therefore, we can't have communism. So I'm sorry, all this money's got to come from the people in the street. And it seems to me that France is, I don't know, they'll be sharpening up the guillotines. I have predicted for the last couple of years, at some point, if they keep going in the direction they're going, there's going to be violence against the ruling elite, which I'm personally opposed to violence. But I understand, you know, if somebody hits you in the face, you're probably going to swing back. So, but at any rate, your thoughts on what's going on with France. It's amazing to me, not amazing, but interesting that the ruling elite can put people in a bad situation and put themselves in a bad situation where the people are literally on the verge of violent revolution and they like can't see it. And they'll say, no, that would be communism. We just got to, you people don't know your place. Shut up, go back to what you were doing and we will continue to pillage and take everything that you have. Your thoughts on France?
Thanks, Garland. You know, there's a really fundamental thing that people just don't really understand about the national debt and about taxation and the national budget. And Karl Marx pointed out quite a long time ago now that under capitalism and in a capitalist state, profit is privatized and debt is nationalized. This happens repeatedly and endlessly. The most recent kind of very well-known occasion of this taking place was, of course, in 2008, when the whole banking system, the whole capitalist banking system was in free fall. And Gordon Brown and Barack Obama got together and said, bloody hell, we have to save the system. These companies are too big to fail. If they fail, the whole lot is going down the tubes. So what are we going to do? We are going to bail them out. So the public paid to nationalize the banks. As soon as the banks were back on their feet, they became privatized again. So we had a situation where what we basically did was take on a huge amount of debt to save monopoly capitalist corporations. We actually did the same thing again in 2020. There was a massive stock market crash. The ruling class took on a whole load more debt. They called it a COVID bailout and pretended it was to spend money on the people. But the reality was that the vast majority of those funds went to subsidize and bail out monopoly corporations who were suffering from that massive stock market crash. So as you see, the profit, when those companies are in profit, they're not sharing it with the rest of us. Of course they're not. They've got a million different ways to make sure they don't pay any tax. That, of course, is something that infuriates people. But what they have to recognize is there's not a way within this system to fix that problem. And I'll come back to this issue about taxation. But you can see why people are demanding or pointing to the fact that these corporations evade tax when they're profitable. When they are losing profit, when they start to look shaky financially. And this tradition goes all the way back. I've talked to you about this before, haven't I? But actually goes all the way back to the very first mega corporation, which was the East India Company, which was deemed too big to fail all the way back in the 18th century and given the most phenomenal bailout by the crown. Because if the East India Company went down, the British economy was going to go down with it. And they lent the most unprecedented sum of money. They basically took on public debt to stop the East India Company from collapsing when its profits. And one of the two things that had affected its profits, Garland, at that time, just to show you the continuity of behavior of this system, they had engineered so much looting of Bengal when they took it over after the war at Plassey and other wars, other battles. They had looted Bengal to such an extent that they basically engineered conditions for a famine. And when that famine happened, they were still busy looting, doubling down on taxation collection mechanisms rather than looking at how to help save the people who were starving because of the fact that their whole world had been looted to buggery. And so This mechanism, during the first year of the Bengal famine, the East India Company paid its directors a windfall dividend because they were raking it in so brilliantly, right? But by the end of the famine, they'd created conditions that actually undercut their own profitability, and the scandal had gone around the world of their behavior, and suddenly the company became shaky, and there were holes in its budget, and it was no longer able to maintain that level of wealth extraction that it had been doing. So it started to that there was a massive crash in its stock prices and a hole in the budget because they were, running all kinds of armies, all these expenses of various armies and things, and running a state. And they basically went to the British government cap in hand and said, "You're going to have to bail us out." Now, not only did the British government realize, "Oh no, we are going to have to because otherwise our whole economy is going down," but also, of course, half of the MPs in Parliament were East India Company stock holders. Right. So, look at that whole picture. If you think this kind of nepotism, corruption, and the reliance of this, or the dependence of the state on the mega corporations is something new, it's absolutely not. This is how capitalism develops. This is small companies become mega companies, become too big to fail, right? And their debt consistently is nationalized. So essentially, the national debt is a historical accumulation of all the times we've subsidized and bail out the ruling class, right? We have to pay them to keep exploiting us. That's how the public finances work, and we get taxed. And they have ways of avoiding taxation because tax eats into your profits, don't you know? It's not good for business. But obviously, they need there to be a public treasury, or there's nothing to loot. So the rest of us have to pay as much as possible, and there's a constant kind of drive to try and work out how to get more out of the little people without forcing the big companies to pay their share being a kind of notional concept, in fact, because the bigger the company, the less likely it is to be paying anything at all. So that's the national debt. The hole in the budget is a kind of fact of life under capitalism, in fact, because of the way that the system operates. What is it right now that the ruling class is busy spending our tax money on? Because clearly not on providing the services that we think are the reason that we have to pay taxes, right? They're paying money to subsidize monopoly corporations, to give them ways to make profits out of providing services. The services get smaller because they're being cut all the time. But the amount of profit that goes to the companies who've been tasked with providing those services keeps on flowing, right? So they're able to put their prices up while what they deliver on the front line gets less and less. And then, of course, there's the war drive. The war drive has to be subsidized. And the messages the ruling class wants to give us about all of this, I think, are quite interesting because there's a big discussion going on all over the imperialist world about inflation and how to keep inflation under control. Now, first of all, the inflation we're looking at was to a very large extent created by all the money printing that the banks did to bail out the system in 2008. And have been doing ever since in order to subsidize various activities, including the COVID bailout, including the Ukraine war, all kinds, and various banks and financial institutions that have been melting down since then have been quietly bailed out basically by printing more money. Now, the problem with printing money is you devalue the currency, right? Because the currency in circulation basically needs to reflect the value of the goods in circulation. And if it doesn't, if there's more currency in circulation than is the value of the goods in circulation, what will happen is the each pound or each dollar circulating will decrease in value until they basically level out. That's money as its means of circulation. Money has several functions, but one of them is as a means of circulation. And in that role, if you put more money into circulation than there are goods to balance it out, what you're doing is creating inflation, so the goods become more expensive. What that does is make the people who are in a position to create this money, it means that they now own a larger proportion of the country's wealth, because the people who just receive money in a pay packet, their pay didn't go up because the currency's been devalued. So what's happened to them is they've had a pay cut without anybody having to fight them. They're not able to buy as many things as they could before with their money because the value of the currency has gone down. This is the inflation that we're seeing. And to a large extent, it was created from 2008 onwards, this particular kind of massive rise in inflation, all the money printing. But of course, it was then exacerbated by the NATO's war in Ukraine and the huge amount of, number one, money printing that they got into to fund that war, but also the massive spike in energy prices when they cut us off from cheap Russian oil and gas. And that, of course, when you make energy prices go high, every type of production and every type of transport gets more expensive, and therefore every single thing that's either produced or even just being moved around becomes more expensive. So we've had a double whammy in terms of what our wages will buy. And it's no one, this is being called the cost of living crisis, right? This is a massive inflation crisis that's been entirely created by the rich, from which the rich have benefited and from which the poor are suffering more every day. But what's happening is, because there's this discussion, it's always put across to us like, if there's a hole in the budget, if there's a budget deficit, then it's bad governance. And the government has to fix the problem by balancing the books. And how are the government going to balance the books is always the question. And the discussion right now in the financial papers is, well, the government really needs to get a handle on inflation. Now, the official bourgeois narrative about inflation is it's caused by high wages. Again, this is an argument which was debunked in detail by Karl Marx back in, I think, 1861, somewhere around there. He gave a brilliant speech to the First International, the Working Men's International, that was based in London those days. So he used to go to the meetings and address it regularly, and he was an active participant. It's also known as the First International, First Working People's International. And he gave a speech which is later published as Wages, Price and Profit. And everybody should read it. It's really worth understanding and he systematically debunked arguments. And the reason he did that was there was a radical English worker or British worker who had presented a thesis to the International that said workers shouldn't strive for higher wages because all they do is create inflation, and that basically negates the effect of the pay rise. The wages go up, the prices go up, and you might as well have not bothered. This is what the bourgeoisie tells us all the time. They tell us this is true. Marx showed it's absolutely not true. He said what he showed was there might be a temporary rise in the price of a few things, but in fact, over time, what happens is that levels out, and it's not over everything. It's over just some things that the workers are suddenly able to put more demand in. That very quickly evens itself out in the economy. And over time, what you get is with higher wages, the thing that actually comes down is profit. So the what you're looking at is how is value that's been created? Let's not forget the value has been created by the work of workers, right? They have created value by their labor, through their laboring power, right? They've created value. And where that goes to, the extra value they created in a new product is divided essentially into wages and profit. So the higher the wage, the lower the profit, the lower the wage, the higher the profit. That's it. That's the essential rule of capitalism and how wealth gets divided. So even with a small profit, the capitalists are still ripping us off, right? Because they're getting money for nothing. But the reality is their drive is always to push wages down as low as possible so that they can keep profits as high as possible. So they tell us this fairy story that says high wages are the reason we've got inflation. And like that right now in Britain, there's this massive kind of push on the Chancellor and to to, well, the Chancellor just doing the bidding of the ruling class, but it's being presented like the sensible economists have to explain to the Chancellor she must be firm with the public sector and not buckle to their desire to have a pay rise that keeps up with or even goes ahead of inflation. Let's not forget that public sector workers have essentially been having real terms pay cuts since 2008, right? So in every sector, in fact, in Britain, people's pay now is way behind what it was in 2007. If you look at purchasing power, what can you get for your money? And actual numbers don't mean anything, do they, Garland? It's what can you get for your money? How much does a tin of beans cost? You know, can you go on holiday? Can you afford your rent or your mortgage, etc.? And our wages across the board have gone down massively, and everybody has had this huge amount of pay austerity and real terms pay cuts. And sometimes it can be hard to realise because, you know, if some sectors had a 5% pay rise, why are they so greedy? It's like, well, but inflation was 8%. So 5% is still a pay cut, right? But it's presented like it's this massive pay rise. And again, this really helps the bourgeois narrative manipulation about these things, because they don't explain that actually these still workers are still far behind where they used to be. They're still struggling to make ends meet. We still have, you know, single mothers in full-time work, nurses using food banks because they're single mothers and their salary won't feed them and their children. So this is what's been happening to our wages. This is what's been happening with inflation. There's this narrative that says that the governments must be frugal and must deny these greedy public sector workers a pay rise because that's just going to fuel inflation, when in fact they're the ones who've been fueling inflation, and they've done it to make themselves richer and to fund the things that matter to them, i.e. keeping the system going and keeping the war machine going, right? And they're forcing us to pay the price when they say to us, first of all, they make us bail out their banks, right? And then they tell us, no, well, the government's got to keep paying the interest on its debt. Who are they paying the interest to? They're paying it to the same banks they bailed out. We've got to keep paying tribute to the ruling class who we keep bailing out, and then we owe them money, and we've got to keep paying them interest on the money we owe them. And then, because that's all very expensive, we have to accept cuts to all public services, cuts to the NHS, cuts to education provision, further privatisation of everything, further casualisation of everything. Well, every worker in every possible sphere should be on a 0 hours contract, should be on minimum wage, should be totally flexible, right? And the minimum wage shouldn't rise either. You know, you should basically be at starvation level or below, and still will say that you don't work hard enough and you don't live frugally enough, and the problem is that workers are just lazy. That's the reason the system isn't working, people, for you. It's working fine for us, by the way. You know, so this is the real substance of the discussions that are being had. And this question of taxation, I'll just finish with this, if I may. This question of taxation is a really important one, because people see that they are being taxed to the hilt for a thousand different mechanisms, not just one tax, are there? There's hundreds of bloody taxes. You're left, right and centre, you're taxed. Sometimes an item you're taxed on three or four times, you know. And it's clearly the taxation burden is pretty unbearable, iniquitous and unfair. It's very unfairly distributed, the tax. You know, as a proportion of income, if you look, it's the poorest who pay the most. And that is obviously, to anybody who believes in even slightly in fairness, which as humans, you know, we do, we have a fairness bias. We are in favour of fairness and we notice unfairness. You know, you only have to look at two little kids being given a plate of, you know, raspberries by their mum, and they're looking at each other like, have you got more than me? there's an inbuilt fairness bias in human beings. I mean, it's a silly example, but you get my idea. We look and we see it's not fair, the distribution of taxes. It's not fair. That's true. The question is, can we, through tax reform in this system, make it fair? And I have to say the answer is no. Fundamentally, what we're looking at is how the system works. It's like looking at the parliament and saying, well, these people aren't serving us, and we need to re-elect new parliamentarians. And, you know, my father was fond of saying you could have 650 Karl Marxes in the British Parliament. It still wouldn't serve the interests of the working class, because that parliament has been set up as part of the bourgeois state machinery. It's part of, it's one cog in a big machine. And that machine's whole purpose is to keep a tiny exploiting class in power over an exploited majority. How does changing the personnel in a bit of that machine change what the machine is? It doesn't, and it can't. And that's the thing, I think, that people get very misdirected over this idea of tax. And a lot of people's time and energy goes into fighting for the reforms in the tax system, right? But look at what's gone on since the Second World War. Since it became evident to the ruling class that higher taxation was going to be demanded to pay for more social provision for more workers, they set up the most phenomenally complex network of tax loopholes and tax havens that work in tandem. A whole system of being able to set up a shell company here and another one here, another one there. So it's basically replaced. Remember, before and during the Second World War, the system of choice was the anonymous bank account in Switzerland. And Switzerland was the banker. Switzerland was neutral, i.e. they were the place where all the bourgeois could hide their loot and it couldn't be touched. And Switzerland was the place you could open a bank account without having to say who you were or what you were or what your money was, what you were putting in your safe, or where your billions of bars of gold came from. It's fine, just put it all here, that's fine. And Switzerland made very nice money out of performing this function for the international ruling classes. Well, the tax havens now are the new version of that. You know, that system got exposed to too great an extent. And so it kind of outlived its usefulness, and a new system's been set up. And, you know, for as long as you have these super rich oligarchs who sit on these types of colossal fortunes, they will either make sure that the way the law is written contains just enough of a loophole for someone like them with the right number of full-time lawyers and accountants to work out how to bypass it, or they will work and they will make sure that another whole system of stashing your loot is set up so that we're busy destroying one, they're busy setting up another one. The whole point is you cannot expect fairness from a system that is based on the appropriation of the wealth of the many into the hands of the few. That is what capitalism is. You can't ask capitalism to be fair when it's based in inequality, it's based in exploitation. If you want fairness, you are going to have to move on to socialism and give up your prejudice that says capitalism is this fair, equal system and communism is something that's somehow anti-worker, because, of course, the reality is it's the exact opposite of the truth. Now, a lot of people have cottoned on to the fact that when the imperialists make horrible accusations at their enemies, they're actually making confessions. It's time for us to apply that to the ultimate one, which is all the terrible things they say about communism, they're describing capitalism. And all the lovely things they say about capitalism, they're actually describing communism. And if you could, you know, do that flip, that mental flip, it's just the next logical step in where you've already got to, you might start to be able to make a bit more sense of the world.
You know, one of the things I found interesting is, I was thinking while you were talking that the United States, you know, one of the things they talk about, our system works because we have three branches, the legislative, the judicial, and the executive branch. And we have a system of, I love this, checks and balances, right? And what they do is they maintain an equilibrium. And if one goes too far in the wrong direction, we've got other two to straighten them out. But there's one thing that isn't discussed. What is this thing that they're maintaining? What is this equilibrium that they're keeping? You know what I mean? It's a checks and balances to keep something going just right. But what is that thing? Is that thing something to look out for the, you know, for the poor and the downtrodden, or to maintain the working class? If you look at it, it seems to be that that's the discussion that needs to be had. What is it? This checks and balances maintains what? And the answer is, what is the output? What do we get? We get wars, we get piracy all over the world, and we get oppression of people here in the country who try to speak up and say, hey, there's a problem. So the outcome is what we get. Let me read something to you. This is a quote from Friedrich Merz, former BlackRock CEO and current Chancellor of Germany. Those things are inextricably linked. I'll put it like this.
Entirely unrelated, Gardens.
Yeah, completely. Merz, recently. There is a deep-seated fear of war among parts of our population. I don't share it, but I can relate to it. That's the other part of it. Here you have a guy who's got like barely double-digit support, the barely double-digit support in this country. And his problem is that it's a problem out here, and these people are afraid of war. Now, they're the ones that'll die. Their kids got to go to war and die. They're the ones that'll be, they're the ones that'll suffer. I'll be in a bunker somewhere. But so clearly, I don't share it. That's like a rich person saying there's a deep-seated fear of poverty and starvation. Now, I don't share that because I'm rich and I've got like all the food and everything I want, but I can relate to it. Your thoughts on this? And now they're all like the latest. A Russian drone has violated our airspace. We must go to war.
Totally. Let me just come back quickly on your comments about the checks and balances, Garland, because I think you've really put your finger on something important, which is the checks and balances are there not to protect the people from a government that wanted to act against their interests. It's there to protect the status quo. And the status quo, as you quite rightly pointed out, is the oligarchs remain in charge and their business is what the state dedicates itself to doing. Let's just give us a small example. I regularly you see in the USA, you have these kind of bun fights over the budget, don't you? And then what happens? The budget can't get passed because we don't have enough votes in there, there's a kind of hiatus. And what has to happen is some demands in the budget that were made to keep the base happy have to be got rid of so it can be voted through the parliament. Now, Congress, whatever, whichever bit of your system that is. In our country, we have this fabulous thing called the upper house. So it's brilliant because even if a government puts through some legislation that the masses might really be demanding in the hopes it's going to make their life a bit better, we have this thing called the House of Lords. And the House of Lords will then inspect the legislation and go, we don't like this, and we don't like this, and we don't like this, and kick it back. And it can go back several times. And basically what you're looking at is the process of chipping away anything that might have been slightly threatening to the status quo until what passes is acceptable to all parties. So you're absolutely right. The checks and balances are not about stopping abuses of power. They're about making sure that the proles don't actually get to pass anything that upsets anybody in the higher ups, right? So that's what the checks and balances are for. That's the essence of their nature. So they're held up to us as this proof of fantastic democracy. In fact, a real working class democracy, the first one of which we saw in 1871 in the Paris Commune, which was studied by Marx and Engels and studied again by Lenin and was the basis of workers' democracy later that came out of the Soviets in the Soviet Union. Workers' democracy does not separate the legislature from the executive. The people who make the laws are responsible for implementing them. So you don't have this like, oh, well, I've done my best, nothing to do with me. And then if those laws are then not implemented, those people can be recalled. They're people, so the people who voted for them say, you're not doing your job, mate. So there are fundamental principles of a working class democracy to ensure it really serves the people. One of them is no special treatment. You are supposed to have an average worker's pay and you're going to work harder for that pay. So it's not the job for someone who wants an easy life. You don't get special privileges and special treatment. Another one is you should be subject to recall. So it's not just a question of you can tell a bunch of lies every 5 years. And once people have elected you, they've got no ability to influence you and no ability to bring you back when you haven't done the job you were supposed to do. So the principle of recall is built in to genuine working class democracy. And then, of course, there's this not separating the legislature from the executive. You have the one body does both, which means that actually you can measure how well your representatives are doing for you, because they not only pass the laws, but they see them oversee the implementation of the laws, right? So this is what mass democracy, working class democracy looks like. It's the polar opposite of what is called representative and what we would call bourgeois democracy, i.e. capitalist democracy, which is democracy for the capitalists, by the capitalists, of the capitalists, and dictatorship against everybody else. And then you were talking about Merz's problem with the fact that not enough people have realized that they shouldn't be afraid of war.
If I may, let me show you some of you probably haven't seen the evidence. And I mean, in light of this overwhelming evidence, I can certainly see where he's, where these people are horrified of the Russians. So apparently the Polish government said that they were attacked by Russian drones, and they provided evidence. You're going to love this. They said there was a Russian drone that somehow landed on a chicken coop. I was making this up. Let me show you a picture of this Russian drone that we were provided that landed on a chicken coop. Now, you may notice something about this. Number one,
so
there's woods behind. This is literally the picture. There's trees behind it. Now,
that's definitely how drones land, Garland.
Yeah, the Russians drone here, this attack drone, I guess, from the Russians, flew through these trees, because I guess it had to be going forward without somehow disturbing or crashing into any of these branches, and landed in this direction directly on a chicken coop. Now, I would think it would have some forward inertia and that it would slide off the chicken coop going 400 or 500 miles an hour, but apparently not. Or this is a special drone that somehow has a reverse gear, and it flew over here forward and backed up to the chicken coop. But some kind of way, this brilliant piece of technology that the Russians put together kind of looks like a little model drone to me. But literally, the government provided us this, was able to make its way. It's so diabolical and evil. It made its way through a bunch of pine trees, going forward, landed on a chicken coop. But thank God for us, the Poles were able to get this evidence for us, so that we now know we must all face the evil Putin. I wish I was making this up. I wish I was making it up, Jody.
What is really upsetting, Garland, is how many serious mainstream, i.e. corporate imperialist media, will present this photo like it actually is evidence, with no commentary that points out why this evidence is maybe not very plausible, right? And this is part of how we can see that what we're looking at is a massive manipulation. What we're looking at is evidence of the Europeans trying to, number one, keep the war going any way they can, number two, pull the US back in, because they want to, they're staging a provocation that they hope can trigger Article 4, Article 5 in the NATO Constitution that says everybody now has to join in. Of course, actually, it doesn't say they have to. And you know, with the US and the British, like with everything, they will if they want to. But they want to try and trigger this panic that says, no, everybody has to get involved now. They want to make it a directly NATO war, because the Ukrainian forces are being defeated, and at some point soon they're going to completely collapse. And this is the Europeans' way of trying to make that happen, at least bring more NATO forces into Poland and up to the border, ready to go in case of the full collapse of the Ukraine regime. That's actually what we're looking at, Garland. And that photo is absolutely laughable. I mean, for one thing, I'm no military expert, but if that thing was flying, never mind the bloody trees, if it was flying at great speed, that hen coop doesn't look strong enough to stand up to the impact of the drone landing on it, right? If it came out of the sky at a great speed, surely that little wooden structure would have collapsed and shattered into loads of pieces. It wouldn't just land like a little feather on the roof, would it? I mean, drone experts, write in and tell me, unless somebody stood there bringing it down, right? Obviously, you can do that. But that's not what they're saying has happened, right? They're saying this flew thousands of miles and just randomly landed in Poland. And they're also saying that for some reason, unbeknownst to man, it kind of goes along with the whole stupid Hollywood narrative of the Ukraine war generally, doesn't it? One day, Vladimir Putin, for no reason that anybody can possibly fathom, because how can you possibly understand such evil? He woke up one day and just wanted to invade the country next to him and take it over and wipe out its people, because that's what madmen are like, isn't it? And because we watch so many superhero movies, like, there's enough people who buy into that nonsense, right? Of course, it's not what happened. It's not an explanation of what's going on. And why on earth, just stop and think about it, Russia is winning in every sense, in every respect. It's winning diplomatically, it's winning militarily, it's winning economically, it's winning socially. Why on earth would Russia suddenly attack Poland? They've got zero reason to do that. Right? Zero. It makes no sense at all. But when you understand that these drones are all over Ukraine, because they're cheap drones that the Russians send in to overwhelm air defences, and they're very easy to pick up ones that haven't been destroyed and, you know, repurpose them and reuse them. And that is what the Ukrainians do. That is a, you know, perfectly normal. But, you know, for the Ukrainians to set up this, oh, look, it must be the Russians what done it, because here's a few of their cheap drones that there's loads of hanging around in Ukraine. It makes no sense. None of it adds up. It's quite clearly from the beginning, you should have been suspicious the first day you read those headlines, simply because there's no reason for Russia to want to attack Poland. And we already had a fake scare about an attack on Poland, didn't we? Remember that there was a, like, oh, the bombs fell in Poland and there was some farmer who was supposed to have, you know, been under the bombs. And, you know, they do these big splashes in the Western press, and all of it is about narrative management. But it ties in completely to what Mertz was saying, because, of course, part of the narrative management is not just saying, Putin's a madman and he's coming for us and he's not going to stop at Ukraine, you know, he's going to come to Poland, he's going to come to the Baltics, he's going to keep going and keep going, we're going to have to fight him somewhere. And this narrative is an important one for softening up the populations in the West. Number one, you've got to soften them up to just accept you keep spending money on the war, even if you don't send any soldiers from here. It's very unpopular how much money we spend from the treasuries of the West to fund this war, billions and billions and billions, while we're being told there's no money for anything that we need, right? So that's one. Number two, there is a desire in the Western imperialist powers to prepare their populations to actually participate in war if it comes to that. They prefer to fight the wars by proxy. It's very threatening to their social cohesion if they mobilize their home populations for war. But that doesn't mean they'll be able to get away without doing that. So they, step by step, they're trying to soften us up. They're trying to prepare us for accepting that we need to go to war with Russia, that Russia is a big enemy, that Russia is this crazy mad power that has to be stopped. Putin is the new Hitler, all this type of rubbish. And this is all part of that narrative management and control and psychological operation to try to create a war ready sentiment amongst the populations, the working class populations in Germany, France, Britain in particular.
Last, before we go, is your thoughts on the current state of affairs, what's going on with the madness of Zionism. You know, now they'll just say they'll attack any country in the world. And of course, the US is playing the old, we're trying to control them and we're trying to stop them from doing things. We didn't know they were going to attack Qatar. Who could have possibly saw that coming? You know, this, it seems to me that's starting to run out of gas. Although there are a lot of people in this country that still run around and say, Israel controls our country. We're just puppets to Israel. I'm like, yeah, okay. That's like me saying my fingers control my body. I can't control my fingers. They just do crazy things every now and then. I'm like, don't do that. Bad fingers. Don't do that. And the fingers are like, I'm not listening to you.
Totally. So it's very clear now, isn't it? The genocide is fundamentally, it's a genocide of Anglo-American imperialism, with the European Union in enthusiastic support. And this is a war between the imperialist bloc, essentially NATO, and the peoples of the Middle East. Zionism is the attack dog. Israel is the attack dog. It's their unthinkable aircraft carrier in the Middle East. It's also the arm's length operation that the imperialists really prefer, which is deniability. Then they get to parachute themselves in as the peacemakers and the peace brokers and the intermediary. I'm just a neutral arbiter. I've come to help you sort out your differences, you silly little children who keep fighting each other. If only you'd be reasonable, let me help you. But of course, they're the ones who are pulling the strings of the Zionists, and they're the ones who create the ability of the Zionists to carry out these crimes with no answerability, right? There's nobody who can hold Israel accountable. Why is that? The whole world is screaming, why can't Israel be held accountable? And of course, the reason is because the UN, Britain, the imperialist powers stand behind Israel, and they create a situation in which it's not possible for any of the rest of the world to do anything. And I think what that then plays into things we're seeing right now, isn't it, in the international sphere, because on the one hand, we've got the United Nations meeting, and we've got this whole ritual of a bunch of even imperialist countries agreeing with the majority that the state of Palestine should be recognized. It's all in words. It's all to calm their own people from the imperialist point. I mean, from the mass of the world, they want justice. They're sick of watching this, right? They bring these resolutions, but then they're kind of toned down, and it becomes this thing where there's a kind of show of virtue by a whole load of complicit governments. We have Macron standing there, of all people, you know, saying, yes, we're going to recognize the state of Palestine. What does it mean? What are they recognizing? Palestine is entirely occupied, bombarded, starved, genocided. What is it you're recognizing? That Palestine has a right to exist? We already knew that. What is it that these words mean? They're not taking any action to stop Israel. What they're trying to do is convince their home populations that the actions going on, that are being the crimes that are being committed by the Israeli genocidal machine, are nothing to do with them. And they're as horrified as you are, and they stand with the global majority, and they're just as impotent. Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron want the people to believe that they're as impotent as you and me, standing by and watching these horrific crimes. But the truth is quite the reverse. They are participants. They are helping to direct these crimes, right? So it's a total lie. It's a charade that's happening in the UN right now. Meanwhile, there's an interesting development going on with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and China launched its Global Governance Initiative. It's launched several other initiatives over recent years about how, as a global community, there's better ways of doing things, right? Now, what I find interesting about this is, although, in fact, the UN Secretary General was at the meeting and has endorsed the initiative, right? And the Chinese have been very firm in saying, we're not trying to replace the United Nations. We're trying to make sure that the United Nations system works properly, as was intended. Well, of course, what people intended the UN to do differed depending on who they were. But what is true is that because the UN was founded 80 years ago in the wake of World War II, because one of the big powers that emerged from World War II was the USSR, there was an acceptance in words, if not in deeds, that was written into the UN Charter of the right of all nations, the equality of all nations, no matter what their size, the right of self-determination, all these type of things, and an acceptance of international law of the type that came out of the Geneva Conventions and the Nuremberg Tribunals. So these are principles that people all over the world would happily accede to if they ever had the chance. Of course, the reality is, while imperialism is, while you've got the big bully there with the gun in his hand and over your head, right, this whole thing of lying there going, I think we should live in peace, that doesn't really work, does it? But the Chinese are asserting at a time when the mass of the world is so disgusted with the impotence of the UN system and the way that the imperialists block every mechanism that is supposed to enable the international community to actually intervene on behalf of and to stop crimes on behalf of the oppressed and to stop crimes from being carried out. It's never been able to do that because of the US and British vetoes. Nevertheless, in words, it says that's what it's for. So the Chinese are saying, well, we take the UN Charter at face value. We believe in the principles that are enshrined there, which came out of this strange equilibrium of forces between the imperialist camp and the socialist camp after World War II. And we want to help that be the way the world really is governed in the future. And so a whole load of countries have already come out in support of that. The UN Secretary General did. And what we're going to see increasingly is a competition over the dominant narrative. I think, although the Chinese say they're not trying to replace the UN, I think it's a bit like the BRICS alternative trading system. They're not going to have any choice. If they really mean what they say, and they do want to help the world have a fairer, more equitable way of conducting its affairs, where the strong cannot dominate the weak, and where everybody, you know, the system works for everybody and everybody gets a say in how the system operates, there's no alternative but to steadily build something that is parallel to and ultimately eclipses the system that the imperialists have got such tight control of that it's impossible to use it for anything, even when the huge majority of the world's population is behind it, as we've seen in practice endlessly with the situation of the genocide in Palestine, the ICJ rulings, all the resolutions, you know, and all the words, all the hot air in the UN about how genocide must be stopped and Palestine must be recognized. And, you know, how many resolutions over the decades have there been about the rights of the Palestinian refugees to return home, Garland? You know, this is not a new thing that the UN has failed to deliver for the Palestinian people, right? But it's being brought to a head now, and it's a very interesting timing for the Chinese to launch their initiative.
Yes, I agree. I think it's people are starting to recognize that the West and the imperialists set up, whether it's the UN or, you know, these other systems, they set them up to benefit them and to allow them to continue their exploitation of the world. And that I'm going to recommend to people something that I did recently. Give me a second. What I did was, if I can find it, I did. Here we go. This, I would recommend people that they look over. I did a video recently, revisiting President Putin's Empire of Lies speech. That's the video that I did. I went over the Empire of Lies speech. I recommend people check out that video. It's very important to reread that speech right now, because in it, he talks about a lot of the things that you're touching on. He gets into how we got to where we are, and basically saying these people set up systems, they made agreements, and the agreements are only as good as long as it benefits them. As soon as it doesn't benefit them, they completely reverse them. You know, when you look at it and you go down, and I'm like, hey, he's been listening to Jody Brar. This guy's been watching my videos, apparently. You know, but, and this was, it was a recognition. What's interesting is, I don't want to keep you too long. What's interesting is that as the imperialist continued or really upgraded their attack on Russia, from the Soviet Union to Russia after 1991, that this period of time leading up to the special military operation, seems to me it was very eye-opening that a lot of people that came in with Vladimir Putin were like, we're going to make friends with the imperialists, we'll work with them, we'll all make money together. And when you read that speech, you realize that he and Lavrov et al. Woke up and said, holy crap, socialists were right. These people are lying. That's what the Empire of Lies speech is basically. My God, the socialists were right about the imperialists. Everything they said was 100% right. And let me repeat it myself. So I recommend people check out my video, Revisiting President Putin's Empire of Lies speech, 24 February 2022. That's the name of the video. I actually did it a couple of weeks ago, because when you listen to that, the Empire of Lies speech, I didn't realize it at the time. It is an attack on imperialism. It is exposing imperialism, and it is saying we have to go to war on our border because the imperialists did everything that imperialists do.
100%. Well, it sounds like an excellent video. I need to go back and reread that speech, because obviously I read it at the time, and that's a long time ago now. So I will go back and reread that, and I'll watch your video, Garland. Thank you. I just want to add a plea to the people in the West who make up the majority of our audience. If you live in an imperialist country, you are not impotent. You must become part of the anti-imperialist resistance. And in an imperialist country, that means you must become a socialist. You must get yourself educated in Marxism. You must study so you can become useful to the working class in your country. And you must help popularize Marxism amongst the workers of your country. Imperialism will always threaten the world while there are kings of finance capital sat on top of these incredible fortunes, which they have looted over centuries from the people of the planet, including your own people, including you and your families, right? These people must be dispossessed. They can't be allowed to continue to use the loot that they have amassed in these nefarious ways. It is their control of so much resource that enables them to control all the systems and stop them from working in the interests of ordinary people. They are the ones who have perfected this machinery, not just of looting, but of social control. All of that has to be dismantled, right? When we talk about overthrowing imperialism, that's what we mean. And imperialism must be overthrown. Its state machinery of coercion, control, looting must be dismantled in favor of genuine democracy for the masses, for the mass of ordinary people. And without that, the rest of the people can do all they, rest of the world's people can do huge advances and fight the battles to get liberated, but they will always be threatened unless we are also doing our job here. And we must recognize, if we don't do our job, it's not just people abroad who will suffer, it's also us. If you look at what's happening with the cost of living crisis and what we were talking about earlier in the show, look at the drive into an all-out full confrontation World War III. All of that affects you, and we have to stop thinking like war is something far away and economic trouble is something far away, doesn't touch me, I'm all right, Jack, don't worry about it, look the other way. This is built into the system. The impoverishment of the masses, even here at home, is built into the system. And so I really ask people to start becoming part of the solution and stop sitting on the sidelines and hoping someone else is going to fix this problem for you.
Jody Brar, where can everybody find you and follow you check out all of your information and your organization?
Thank you. So I have a Telegram channel. It's just my name, Jyoti Bra. My party has a Telegram channel, The Communists, with an S. That's our website, thecommunists.org. Do sign up to our newsletter there. Do follow us on Telegram. Do subscribe to our newspapers. And we have a fantastic YouTube channel called Proletarian TV, where there's a huge load of resources, speeches and presentations on all kinds of topics going back many, many years. So a fantastic resource there also.
Thank you. And before we go, you know who we have to hear from? Keir Starmer. Jody Brar, everyone, make sure you share this on all your social media platforms.